All right. Good morning. This is Eric Elveston, Senior Fellow for the Center for the Advancement of Christian Education. I'm trying something new today. You've read blogs from me before. We've done webinars before. We've had experts with us and much more formal fashion. This is a little bit more of an informal opportunity to have a conversation. Wrote a blog when I first started with Case about entitled, I've Got a Guy. And in that, touch base on just the Chicago way and growing up in Chicago of knowing people and having people to rely on in the education profession. And so the person that I spend probably the most time talking about education with and change and innovation and leadership is my friend John Eckert. And John's a professor at Wheaton College, works for CTQ, has worked for the Department of Education, and is a lifelong educator. Does research in teacher effectiveness, strategic compensation, and collective leadership, which I think we'll talk a little bit about today. And then has written The Novice Advantage, which I love. And you have given away, I think, John, you'll like this, over 100 copies. And then has a new book coming out called Leading Together. So first question for you, John, and I think what I've titled this is three questions. The baseball side of me, three is an easy number for me to remember. But you just published an article or put out an article in Edutopia entitled The No in Innovate, where you say when it comes to innovation, saying no is more than okay. It's essential. So what does saying no, or what have you seen in schools? What does saying no do for school, and why do schools have such a difficult time saying no?
That's a good question. Well, hopefully your threes isn't because you are thinking of strikeouts and you use three pitches and I'm done. So,
you know, I am a pitcher, so.
That's right. I might be swinging and missing here. But the what I see in schools, you know, having taught in schools and then now researched in schools for this next book that comes out, in the high schools I was in, the thing that set the principals apart from ones that I think were less successful is their ability to just kind of keep the plates clear of their teachers so that they could do their work over and over again. The teachers that appreciated their principals would appreciate them, not necessarily for what they did, but for what they made it so that they didn't have to do. And so they just kind of kept things clear, which requires a lot of trust. The principals certainly were not micromanagers. They stepped back and let teachers do the good work that they were doing. Now, I was primarily in high schools for this one, but I see it in middle schools and elementary schools over and over again. And I think what's hard, I think the reason why we have a hard time saying no is there's an urgency to improving things in schools. And so we always know we can get better. So we just keep adding more and more things to try to get better. A friend tweeted in response to that Edutopia piece that as educators, you know, so change should be taking one shirt off and putting on another. But in education, we just keep putting on more shirts, which just becomes cumbersome, makes you kind of uncomfortable, isn't actually very effective. But we feel better because we put another layer on, and it just keeps growing and growing and growing until you kind of get paralyzed by it. I kind of think of the, if you've seen A Christmas Story, when Randy, Ralphie's little brother, is getting sent outside in winter, and he's got all the outerwear on so much that he can't put his arms down. So has to walk with his arms out to that. I feel like sometimes in education, that's where we get. So that's what, I think it's out of good motivation that we can't say no, that we're really just trying to do a better job. But when we do that, then we minimize the efforts that we're already making. And well, I'll say this last thing, we aren't very patient. We don't actually let things, we don't spend years trying to implement things. Other countries are better at this. They take our research and then they apply it and they stick with it for 2, 3, 4, 5 years, because you can't get results a lot of times with most initiatives within a year. But people are impatient, and I think for good reason, but I think it leads to a lack of productivity.
Well, and so that kind of comes to, you know, the next question of, like, in your book, Novice Advantage, you write about technical and adaptive challenges, change, you know, even innovation. And then so in that, how are they different, and why do most innovations not take hold in schools? And it probably, you know, connects a lot with what you just said, but you know, because do you think that most people are trying to do technical changes rather than adaptive changes?
Well, they don't think they are. I think that they see, if there's not much trust in a building or in a district, they're going to go to technical solutions all the time. So this is all Ronald Heifetz's work. And I came across it in Immunity to Change, which is Keegan and Leahy's book that was really helpful for me, because people want to change, but they have things inside them that keep them from moving in that direction. So Keegan and Leahy start with the example of patients that are diagnosed with heart disease that are terminally ill if they don't make major changes to their lifestyles, and only 1 in 7 of those patients is actually able to change. Well, clearly you would assume they want to change. They want to live. They don't want to be miserable, but 6 of 7 can't. And there are things that are internal to you as an individual or internal to your organization that keep you, that fight that change. And unless you're able to identify the things that are going to keep you from actually progressing, it's really hard to make those changes. So we just keep slapping more and more technical solutions on things. Perfect example is standardized testing. Now standardized testing definitely has its place and is valuable, but you know, just saying we're going to test more doesn't mean anybody's going to learn anymore. So there was this great quote from one of the principals I worked with on my capstone project at Vanderbilt in Jefferson County, Kentucky, which is Louisville Public Schools. He said, "You don't make your pig fatter by weighing it more." And so, you can keep testing kids, but that doesn't make them learn anymore. It just gives you some sense of where they're at. And so that's a classic technical solution being applied to an adaptive challenge, which is the adaptive challenge is increasing student learning. The technical solution is let's test more. Well, what we need is a deeper look at why students aren't learning more in a particular context. Well, that takes time, because that's the teacher, that's the student, that's the context that they're coming from, that's the learning environment in the school. There's a lot there, and it may require some adaptive challenges. Now, some technical solutions might help along the way, but if you don't shift your mindset as a team, as an individual, then you're probably not going to get that far on something as challenging as improving student learning, because that's a big thing, and that's an adaptive challenge that we just don't take enough time to address what is at the heart of the reason why you're not getting the success that you want.
So can you give me an example of like a place you've been or places you've been where you've seen the same solution implemented, and one was truly adaptive, you know, where it had the innovative nature where it changed the organization, but the other place it was the technical, where it was just kind of that slap on that next sweater?
Yeah. So the PLCs are the perfect example, professional learning communities. You say PLCs in some schools, and it's like you're using a four-letter word. And it's so sad, because it means a professional learning community. Who isn't for that? I mean, we're educators, right? And we're professionals, and we want to learn, and we want to be a community. There's nothing in it that's innately problematic. But people hate them because they had become top-down. I just had a conversation with two teachers last night where they had a horrible experience PLCs because it became a way to be micromanaged. Everybody had to give the same test at the same time. The test was written by someone else. They had no say over it. So, and it just became this like control mechanism from kind of central organizing, central planning. And so they hated PLCs. Well, that's a classic technical solution. And it actually is corroding the community and the work environment of that school. Whereas other places, one of the high schools I was at had a really robust PLC philosophy. And actually, they're right now, they're on a late start because every Wednesday they have a late start where they meet in their department teams. And I sat in on their meetings, and there was a chemistry PLC that was meeting, and they were designing a new lab together where they had a second year teacher who was leading the PLC because he'd been a bench chemist before he went into teaching, and he knew how to do the technical procedures better than anyone else in the department, while another teacher was working on assessments for that unit with a special education teacher and how they could differentiate and modify. And they're all in the same room. They're all doing different things together to move things forward, doing the work that they really care about. And it was a really rich professional learning community because they were all learning together, but it was very much directed by the teachers themselves. And I'm sure there was a protocol that they were following, but it was a very loose protocol to let them do what they needed to do. So that's a perfect example. I mean, PLCs, some places are great and they're the lifeblood of the school, and other places they're the devil.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, just to kind of touch on the new book that's coming out, you know, Leading Together, that you even mentioned that one of the case studies in there, they voted to get rid of PLCs.
Yeah.
So, well, let me ask you a question. Number three is, in the new book, you provide research and case studies on collective leadership. You know, so can you explain a little bit more, you know, what you mean by collective leadership, and then, and how it plays out differently in the schools that you research? Mm-hmm. And then why is, you know, collective leadership maybe a more, you know, traditional, maybe a little bit more old fashioned in some ways, but much more innovative in the sense of, you know, long-term sustainability in comparison to, you know, some of the stuff where we consistently look for, you know, that superhero leader or, you know, the silver bullet solution to, you know, our educational issues.
Yeah. So, collective leadership, the definition, I give you that basically. Collective leadership encompasses the practices through which teachers and administrators influence colleagues, policymakers, and others to improve teaching and learning. So it builds off of the work of York, Barr, and Duke that came out in 2004. It's kind of the seminal piece on teacher leadership. And so it expands on it to say it's not just teacher leadership or administrator leadership. I mean, so often in when you read in the literature, school leadership is synonymous with administrators. And that's just so silly, because any good school administrator knows that they're only as good as their team of teachers. And if you're going to change anything in the classroom, yeah, and you're going to change anything, any outcomes for kids, it goes through teachers. And so this idea of shared leadership, distributed leadership, there's other terms that have been used are out there. I like collective leadership because I think it really taps into the research on collective expertise. You know, one of the things I hate is talking about getting teacher buy-in. Like, ill, because it sounds like you're selling an idea that you just want somebody else to buy into. And I hate that notion. And so to me, it's not about buy-in. It's about getting the expertise of your team so that you come up with a better solution to begin with. And then as you implement it, you can make course corrections as you go. And so collective leadership is a really useful term that I think good schools are already doing this. I think they could probably improve on it. I think there are ways they could do it better. So in the book, it goes through case studies, but then it forces you to ask some really hard questions. I'm kind of like the third party kind of consultant that can walk into your building through the book and say, are you doing this? Or what's your intention with this? Are you really comfortable sharing power with teachers? Or is it just lip service? Are you really still getting buy-in and rubber stamping whatever it is you want to do? Or are your solutions getting better because collectively you're working toward adaptive solutions instead of just slapping more technical solutions on adaptive challenges? So that's the way I think it's different. That's the reason why I think it works. I like it, the term, way better than distributed leadership, because distributed leadership sounds like you're kind of distributing tasks and delegating work, and that's not what this is. All right, it's a collective thing. Now, you absolutely need great principals. The three high schools I was in, that was the commonality. They had really good principals that were kind of the humble servant leader types. They cast a vision with their team, but then they supported the ideas that bubbled up from the classroom. And I think that makes all the difference for collective leadership. So we absolutely need great principals. I don't want anybody to read into this that I'm marginalizing principals. I mean, they're more important than ever in a collective leadership framework because it's such a different way to think about leadership. And it takes a pretty confident leader to step back and trust his team to lead with him or her.
Well, in that definition, you also add policymakers. I got to imagine that even in your role as a, you know, college professor, you know, and as a researcher and writer, you've added some complexity to just our traditional understanding of school leadership, whether it be teachers or administrators. Like, how have you seen that play out when, you know, a district or schools or even, you know, I think you're working with some even states in some past experience. Like, how have you seen them? How have you seen the impact of this idea of collective leadership from, you know, such a high level policy university to even the foundations to all the way down into the schools and in the classroom?
Right. So in South Carolina right now, we're doing a collective leadership initiative through the Center for Teaching Quality, and we have a pilot of 12 schools. It'll eventually go statewide, but how do you begin to develop this at a state level? So I've got a bunch of survey data right now that I've got to get crunched by early next week on what these schools are finding, where they're at as a baseline, how collective the leadership actually is, to see what, where they need to grow and where they need to push. And I'll be really interested to see how they progress over the course of the year. So I think we need data. A lot of the stuff that Tony Brake's doing with the book Learning to Improve, the networked improvement communities, I think is huge. If we're going to do this work collectively, then we need to be sharing ideas across. And so I think this networking is huge. And that's where I think state and even U.S. Department of Ed could be helpful as a convener. It can't run through them. It's got to be something where that information is shared, which I think is one of the main functions of State Departments of Ed and the U.S. Department of Ed. So if we do that, then that begins to inform policymakers on what works with actual evidence that we're getting better results because we have this leadership that is more collective. So I'm pretty confident. It's my best bet for schools that this is the way we improve, is to do it collectively within buildings and then across buildings, virtually and in person. And I think that's the key. And I think that's what informs policy. And we have a better voice when it's collective like that than if we just try to have the one-off, I'm a teacher, I have this really compelling story, I'm the superhero teacher. That doesn't talk about changing the system. That just makes it seem like you're one person kind of fighting against a system that's oppressing you, and we've got to change the system if we're going to actually make a scalable impact for kids.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, John. Thanks for testing this out with me and trying this out with me. And I think as people kind of look at this in the blog, I'll add your contact information. And I always appreciate the Twitter, the Professional Learning Network that you've helped me develop on Twitter. And, you know, the people.
You're the one who's gotten me into that. So take credit for that, Eric.
Yeah. So, you know, so I think it's pretty fun when, you know, you add somebody like we did, I think yesterday, and all of a sudden, you know, they've added, you know, 100 different followers or new people to connect with and, you know, good books to read and good suggestions. So thanks for being part of this, and I'll send you a copy when I'm done.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, Eric.